welcome to a special episode of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. Today's episode is about the recent riot at the Lee Correctional Facility in South Carolina. The riot was the deadliest in America in the last 25 years. My name is Joshua Ho. I'm formerly incarcerated. I'm also a freelance writer, criminal justice reform activist, and the author of the book Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Joel will be back next week for our next episode. Later, I'll be sharing my interview with a few of the journalists who have been doing the hard work of trying to get to the bottom of what is happening in South Carolina's prison system. First will be Steve Bailey of the Post and Courier, formerly of the Boston Globe, who has been writing about the problems in South Carolina prisons for a long time, and also Victoria McKenzie of the Crime Report, who wrote what I consider to be one of the better stories about the Lee riot for CBS News. But first, my take. On Sunday, April 15th, the riot started at the Lee Correctional Facility in South Carolina. Lee Correctional is a maximum security facility. When the riot finally ended early Monday morning, seven people were dead and 17 more were injured. Perhaps most shocking is that the riot went on for 7 hours. I want to take a second to share the names of the deceased. Raymond Scott, who was 28. Eddie Gaskins, who was 32. Michael Millage, who was 44. Joshua Jenkins, who was 33, Cornelius McClary, who was 33, DeMonte Rivera, I'm not sure what his age was, and Corey Scott, who was 38. Unfortunately, I don't know much more about these inmates, and I'll tell you more a little bit more about why that is in a few minutes. I'm very disturbed and angry about several aspects of the coverage, about how this riot happened, and about the official response. First, I want to discuss the press coverage. I got the names of those deceased gentlemen above from a local paper and from a Newsweek article. In both cases, the stories only listed the names and the rap sheets. The journalists and editors didn't even try to get a quote about each of them from their friends or family. They were literally reduced to only the crimes they committed, and they were left there in perpetuity, only being defined by their worst moments. This is all the world will probably ever know about them. This is probably all I will ever know about them. And that is all their friends and families get to see about them in the paper. I think that's terrible. I think it's very important that we give people an opportunity to be more than their worst moments, as I've talked about before, and to always treat people, especially the victims of violent crime, with some respect. I wish I could say more about them, but that's really all that I know. Formerly incarcerated people like me often ask when the punishment will ever end. We serve our time in prison. We often return to a world of employment discrimination, housing discrimination, and in a way, a kind of social death where we're both supposed to integrate into society successfully and do everything that follows the rules, but at the same time, we're kept at arm's length and told that nobody really wants us. Apparently, to the answer to the question of when will ever finally the punishment be over is never. In this case, not even in death. I'm not saying that Newsweek should have ignored the crimes. I'm not saying that the local paper should have ignored the crimes. I'm saying that they could have had some class and grace. I'm saying they should have done some work and had journalists ask a few questions. I'm saying that the families of those people should have at least been able to talk about their loved ones who died in a prison riot. Another problem I had with the press coverage was how shallow it was across the board. Anyone, and I mean anyone who has ever done time, could tell, just from reading the official accounts, and virtually all of the articles that have come out have really just been about the official accounts, with a few exceptions, that the official count made no sense at all. I'll discuss this more when we get more into the interviews later in the episode. I'm also very angry about the initial responses from people who should know better and for people who have power over all of the gentlemen who are in these prisons. Here's what the governor of South Carolina said immediately after the riot. Governor Henry McAllister, a Republican, said on Monday that the upheaval had been unfortunate, but the flare-up of criminals was inevitable. We know that prisons are places where people who behave externally go to rehabilitate, to get them out of the population, he said. It's no surprise when violent offenses take place in prison. Unfortunately, if you read the official accounts of the Lee riot and you hear stories of broken unit locks, of massive understaffing, of gangs running the prison and vastly outnumbering the correctional officers. And these stories are just from the official reports. You know something was incredibly wrong with how this particular prison system was being run. Calling it a flare-up and saying that it's unfortunate but inevitable really doesn't even come close to understanding what was going on in this prison, which was clearly a failure at the institutional level and clearly a failure of Governor McAllister's administration. And for him to deal with it in such a flippant way, in such a way that took so little responsibility for what was going on, doesn't say much about the quality of his governorship. There are what he, you could call flare-ups at every prison, but they don't last for 7 hours as the correctional officers cower together in a bubble. And I mean the bubble in prison speak is the office where the officers were hiding and basically not trying to stop the riot. Yes, there is violence in prison, but it rarely results in, as Steve Bailey put it in one of his excellent articles from earlier this year, the following kind of violence. 18 people died in state prisons, we're talking about South Carolina, last year. 12 of them murdered by other inmates and 6 by suicide. It took a Freedom of Information Act filing to pry these basic numbers out of the prison system and compare them with previous years. That shouldn't have been necessary. Keep in mind, the prison population has fallen every year since 2010 as the state has diverted low-level offenders from the system. But the rising death toll has been driven by a desperate shortage of correctional officers. 1 in 4 jobs are vacant, and the power of the gangs who increasingly run the prisons. Mental health care remains woefully inadequate. The last 2 years saw an explosion in inmate-on-inmate assaults. Put simply, anyone who can has a knife. There were 250 assaults that required taking inmates to outside hospitals in 2016 and 2017. That was more than double the previous 2 years. Attacks on correctional officers also spiked. Overall, deaths and serious assaults are running at a record pace this year. In the first 2 months, there were 2 murders and a shocking 4 suicides. There were 6 suicides in the 3 months from December through February. That compares with 6 suicides in each of the last 2 years. This mirrors a rise in prison suicides nationally, suggesting this is less a bad patch and more of a deadly trend. So, what was going on at Lee in particular? Well, another recent article gives us a little bit of insight there. The picture painted by inmate families, former employees, the former state prison director, and prison experts, and told through a litany of lawsuits, is one of a poorly conceived and constructed complex. Influenced by prison gangs who outnumber a thin staff of correctional officers who themselves can become complicit in the life or death struggle to consolidate power behind bars. Prison cell doors sometimes don't lock. Gangs are essentially allowed to roam without consequence. In fairness, just today, the news came down that Governor McMaster has allowed the use of vacancy funding to raise correctional officer salaries in the interim as the South Carolina legislature debates increases in funding and benefit packages for correctional officers. In addition, they will be providing netting to complicate cell phones thrown over the fences, even though we all know that the major vector for cell phone smuggling is the correctional officers themselves. There is also going to be an investigation of the Lee facility by a former director of the Texas Department of Prisons. I guess these moves are a good start, but I suspect even the elimination of cell phones and a perfectly functioning cadre of COs will not solve the problem, because what we talked about on our episode about violence, what seems very apparent to me is that there are no positive alternatives for the prisoners. There is no programming that seems meaningful for the prisoners, and there's certainly no hope or anything suggesting that they're moving them from anything from where they started to where they ended up, which is something we talk about almost every week. There's clearly not enough transparency about prisoner and CO behaviors inside the prison at Lee, and a system that believes that creating gladiator schools is an answer to violent crime seems to be what is moving South Carolina politics right now. Until South Carolina starts to treat prisoners first as human beings and works to replace a management and housing system with a system concentrating resources on how inmates return from prison, problems will continue, especially as they continue to increasingly concentrate people who've been accused of violent crimes into less and less facilities. That said, adequate correctional officer to inmate ratios, proper correctional officer training, and better facility management, for instance, making sure all the locks lock, can't hurt and will certainly help. Okay, now that you have some context, let's move on to the interviews. Okay, one of our guests today is former editor of Bloomberg News and a former London business editor for the Boston Globe. His name is Steve Bailey. He's currently a columnist for the Post and Courier and has been doing great reporting about the problems with South Carolina's prison system. Thank you for doing this, Mr. Bailey.
Hi, thanks for having me, Josh.
No problem. Could you give us a quick introduction to how you got involved in reporting on the South Carolina prison system and what you started to find out?
Sure. Like you said, I was at the Boston Globe for years and years. Then I went to London with Bloomberg. And then I got back home where I grew up about 2.5 years ago. And I've been writing columns for the Post and Courier. I'd noticed little items here and there about a death here and a death there. And then I started talking to lawyers who work in the prisons. And it became clear to me that there was a big problem brewing. And I just went back and counted them up. I've written 3 columns in the last 6 months suggesting there are big problems brewing in the prison system here. And unfortunately, I turned out to be right.
So one of the pieces that I read that you wrote talked about a pretty dramatic increase in violence in the prison system. What did you find about violence in the South Carolina prison system, especially in the last 2 years?
Well, if you go back and look in the numbers, last year there were 12 murders and 6 suicides in the state prisons. That's a record year. It took a FOIA, Freedom of Information request, for me to blast the numbers out of the South Carolina Department of Corrections. But we had 12 murders last year. The year before, we had 5 murders and 6 suicides. But if you go back to 2009, there were only 2 deaths total. So the numbers have really been going up. So far this year, by my count, we've had 9 murders and 4 suicides. It's only April. And if you go past the deaths, you can look at another very good indicator are the number of serious assaults, inmate-on-inmate assaults. In the last 2 years, there have been 250 of these that have required them to be taken to outside hospitals. That's double the 2 years before. So the serious assaults have doubled over the last 2 years. Not a good direction.
So obviously, the official story on most of this seems to involve cell phones, which, you know, I was in prison for 3 years, and we certainly had cell phone smuggling, but we didn't have riots or massive increases in the problems that they were having with violence. Do you have any explanation for why they think this is the main cause?
Well, Josh, you were inside, and I'm happy to report so far I haven't, so you're a better expert on this than I am. Listen, there's no question that cell phones are a problem, okay? Everybody knows that. But number one, there's cell phones in every prison in America. There's nothing unique going on here, okay? And number two, what they never talk about is they always suggest that the cell phones are thrown over the prison wall, which they are. But they also come from the guards themselves, for heaven's sakes. There's a story right now going on, but there's an FBI sting. And they've uncovered prison here, a guy who was running a drug ring on the outside. And he was also trying to send a bomb through the mail. What they found that the cell phone came from a guard, for heaven's sakes. It wasn't tossed over the wall. So there is a problem with cell phones. There's no question about it. But I would say here in South Carolina, what sets South Carolina apart is the staffing shortage. There's 1 in 4 prison guard jobs that are vacant. Okay, that's a huge number. There's 600 missing prison guards. Then when you have this shortage of guards, basically the gangs have filled in. They filled the void here, okay? If you want protection, you turn to a gang, okay? So the gangs, and that's really what was going on in Lee. It wasn't so much a riot as there was a fight between the gangs. So that's a problem. There's, you know, as you know, every prison has a lot of mental health issues. So when there's a shortage of guards, what do? You just lock the people up all the time. You don't let people out. And, you know, if you got mental health problems, being isolated is the worst possible thing for you, okay? And finally, the last point I would make, Josh, is, you know, we have had some prison reform here, which is a good thing. The numbers are down, but what happens is they've released quite a few of the nonviolent prisoners, but the population has become more violent. So, you know, just because the numbers are down doesn't need guards, and we still do. So I would suggest that the cell phone thing is true, but it's too simplistic, I would say.
So why do you think they have so many fewer guards or correctional officers in the prisons right now, especially with what you're calling a higher percentage of prisoners with violent crimes.
Okay, I mean, it's not very complicated, right? It's all about money. The legislature doesn't want to fund it, okay? There's nothing very different about our prisoners versus the prisoners in Rhode Island and the prisoners in New Jersey. It's all the same. What's really different here is two things: the lack of funding and also the competence of the people who are running it. And on both scores, we're not very different. That's what sets us off, not our prisoners. Our prisoners are no better, no worse than any other prisoners.
Okay. And you talk about kind of the competence issues. I guess I've heard some reporting that the current head of the department, the department that is in charge, you don't have a DOC per se, that he doesn't have a background in corrections. Is that correct?
Well, he's a very nice guy, Brian Sterling. I know him a little bit. Very nice guy. He says all the right thing. But he was Governor Haley's chief of staff, so he doesn't have a background in prison systems. And, you know, it's complicated stuff. It's not easy. So I would say, if you're looking for kind of examples of competence or lack of, I would say, number one, it starts with the legislature, their unwillingness to fund the prisons. And, you know, frankly, they don't fund the schools here adequately. So if they're not going to fund the schools, they're not going to fund the prisons, because there are no votes in the prisons. Okay, let's face it. You know, other examples I would suggest is Post and Courier, the local paper, did a terrific story, had an excellent story that shows just before the explosion of violence at Lee, they shifted about 300 prisoners from McCormick, which is another prison. So basically, they brought in more gang members to Lee, and they consolidated them all together, and it exploded. What a surprise, okay? And the third example I would show is when they had the Lee riot, it took them 7 hours to put the thing down, for heaven's sakes, okay? They didn't have the people on the ground there, okay? They needed to be able to do, and, you know, a better run place wouldn't have found themselves sitting on their hands for a few hours.
One of the things that we've hypothesized on before on the podcast and discussions with some criminologists is the notion that as the prison populations decline because of criminal justice reform, a lot of times there's a need for actual increased funding, not decreased funding, for some of the reasons that you're raising. And you're saying that it's a political situation where prisoners and prisoner families just don't have the clout to ensure that there's enough funding for the prisons. Do you have any ideas for, you know, ways to turn this around or ways to ensure that this doesn't continue? Because it seems like the prisons in South Carolina are in really bad shape right now.
Listen, we're moving right into election season, okay? And a few days before Lee exploded, one of the leading candidates for the Republican primary for the governorship, her suggestion of prison reform was to shoot them, basically. They don't have the chemicals they need for lethal injection, so she wanted to bring back the firing squads, okay? This is a red state. This passes as progressive thought here in South Carolina, okay? So basically, one thing we could do is elect a few Democrats, for heaven's sakes, if you would. But again, there are no votes in the prisons, and there's no votes, basically, in large parts of South Carolina to basically stand up for prisoners. Okay,
So your suggestion is that just to try to deal with it through elections. Are there any other kind of takeaways that you've had from this before we wrap up?
Well, you know what we need to do, and they are doing this now. I wrote a column for the Crime Report, and I said what we really need is a thorough, independent investigation of what's going on. And they're bringing some people in to look at what happened at Lee, but it needs to be much broader than just looking at Lee. We need an independent investigation that, you know, is outside the Department of Corrections. And let's look at, you know, what's right and what's wrong, what's gone wrong, and how do we fix it? And that's what needs to happen.
I hope that happens for everyone's sake, both inside and out. And thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate the time.
Josh, thanks so much. Bye.
So, one of my guests on this special episode of Decarceration Nation is Victoria McKenzie. Victoria is a departmental editor at the Crime Report, has done temporary assignments for CBS News. She wrote one of the more thoughtful pieces on the Lee Correctional Riot that came out last week, so she's a great person to ask questions about the unfortunate event. Victoria, nice to talk to you, although I wish it were for a happier reason.
Well, same here, Joshua. I'm a big fan of your podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. As I said earlier, it's always weird because you don't always know who's listening. You just know that the numbers. It's nice to actually talk to people who hear it. So you got involved in the story of the Lee Correctional Riot pretty early on. How did that happen?
Well, I've got to say it's two things I credit it for both my presence at CVS and at the Crime Report. Just prior to the riots, we received at the Crime Report, we got some a very thoughtful op-ed from Steve Bailey from the Post and Courier, who had been tracking this rise in violence in South Carolina corrections, even, you know, for the past 2 years, but really recently trying to call attention to a real spike in violence. And because of that, it was on my mind, and I was over at CBS, and the morning following the riots, my editors at CBS really wanted to do something, to do more on a story they thought that needed more attention, seven deaths. So I jumped on it.
It is sort of strange that one of the things that's happened is that so much of the reporting seems to be just replaying the official story. And can you kind of recount what that official story is?
Yes. So the official story was actually predicted to me by the people I spoke to, you know, before the official press conference. You know, I had a number of sources say they're going to talk about cell phones because they have for years. And by they, you know, I'm talking about Brian Sterling, the director of the South Carolina Department of Corrections. And so the official story is that cell phones are kind of the organizing factor in this kind of continuing rise in violence across the state. And when they came out on Tuesday afternoon, I think it was, that was the response. So listen, we've got to get the FCC to let us jam cell phones.
So why exactly would cell phones create one of the biggest riots in the last 25 years, like, according to them?
According to them, gang members are able to communicate with each other, both on the inside and on the outside of the prison. So according to complaints I've read and testimony I've read in front of the FCC, and we can get to the FCC in a minute, but they are used to both to extort family members of prison of inmates, and they're used to actually organize hits on correction officers. So you have this real, you know, asymmetry of power in a very understaffed corrections department and in a very understaffed prison, and that's it. It's a communications tool. Official line is that, look, they're able to continue their criminal activity inside the prison.
I guess my confusion is, as you know, I did 3 years in prison, and, you know, cell phones were a problem there mm-hmm. too, and we had no riots. And most of the people I know were in prisons where cell phones and contraband were a problem and there were no riots. I mean, yeah, there's sometimes some violence, and sometimes that's associated with mm-hmm. gang members, but generally, at least in the prisons that I was in, the gang members, in a way, are working together, even rival gangs, because they form kind of business coalitions, and they mostly take advantage of people who aren't in the gangs. So I'm a little mm-hmm. confused why in South Carolina the existence of cell phones appears to have different effects. You may not have the answer to that, but
I don't, and that's one thing that I set out to try to challenge. And you know, some local reporters are doing a very good job of this as well, but why? That's the question. Why do we have a rise in violence that, you know, you can track sharply from in the last 4 years, and cell phones are ubiquitous in prisons everywhere in the state. In the nation, it just didn't track. And the second side of this is that as a response to this massive riot, to really open the entire, to address the public right after this huge incident of violence by, again, talking about cell phones was pretty stunning to me. It was
because there were reports of, at least I saw, even in the original reporting, I saw reports of things like broken locks on the different floors, incredibly low staff. I mean, terrible staff ratios. It seemed like a total loss of institutional control just from reading the official response, which is, I mean, did you have a similar feeling or did you learn anything else that added to that? Or
yes, I did. So, I spoke with Paul Wright of the Human, he's the executive editor of Prison Legal News, and the Human Rights, was founder of the Human Rights Defense Center. One thing that he pointed out right away was like, look, when you're talking about cell phones in the thousands that are being introduced as contraband, you're really talking, the only way they can get in there is with the collusion of corrections officers. And then you get into the kind of an asymmetry of power there when you have a very understaffed prison, and as we're learning too, a prison where recently a great number of prisoners were just bussed into or transferred to Lee Correctional without an increase of staff.
Oh, they just added a bunch of new prisoners in addition to without restaffing?
Yes, right. And that's something that I'm sure Bailey will be able to speak to a little bit more. I know there's a lawsuit pending on that.
It sounds like a bad episode of Orange is the New Black.
And I don't, for me, it was really stunning. This is not something I knew about. I wasn't familiar with South Carolina corrections before jumping on this report, except to have noted that there was a recent settlement that this 11-year-long action against the Department of Corrections because of abuses of inmates with mental illness.
Oh, that's a pretty constant theme on this podcast has been the absence of good mental health care in prisons and jails. So,
yes. And I think South Carolina really stood out in that. And just about when that case settled, I think it was 2014, 2016, I think it was 2016, not till 2016 that it settled. That's also when Brian Sterling started to really hone in on the FCC to try to block cell phones. And at the one of the critical parts of this lawsuit was the abusive use of solitary in particular for inmates they couldn't manage, inmates they couldn't handle, who were largely mentally ill. Very terrible conditions, solitary cells being, filthy, being freezing. And in my conversation with Justin Bamberg, an attorney and state representative in South Carolina, he was talking to me about prisoners who were caught with a cell phone and then banished to solitary for 2 years as a punishment. And yes, this is what he told me. And he was also talking to me about how this was, this was used as a deterrent for cell phones. People would chill out with cell phones after not wanting to be thrown into solitary for that extreme length of time.
So let me get this. I just want to make sure I understand this. So probably one of the major vectors of getting cell phones into the prison is the correctional officers. The prison is understaffed. At least for most of the reporting I've seen, the security levels in the prison are not maintained. But for some reason, the solution to all of it is to put people in solitary for 2 years for having cell phones that probably the correctional officers are bringing in.
Now, this goes to something I was talking about with Paul Wright, which is why do we have, here you have such a large portion of the state budget really taken over by corrections, yet they're not treating it as an important appointment. It's, according to Paul Wright, he was talking about the rise in, penal bureaucracies where people are just given these appointments, not because they have any expertise on in the area of corrections, but simply because somebody like their buddy needed a job or if it was some sort of patronage appointment. I don't know Sterling's history. I do know that he was a chief of staff of the former Governor Nikki Haley. And I don't believe he has any real expertise in corrections. I mean, you look at him, he came out really like a politician on Tuesday. He was, in fact, smiling. I saw, you know, he had a smile on his face at certain times when he was speaking.
He was smiling really, after a riot where 7 people died, 17 people were injured or more, I'm sure. And where, you know, they still haven't really come up with particularly any answers that I've seen. In your process of going through all this, have you seen anything that looks like there, you know, that might show the way or a path to some solutions to what seems like a pretty terrible mess there?
Well, one thing that is hopeful to me is that they did reach out and ask for a third-party review, for an independent review out of state. And that's going to be led by, let's see, the former Texas Director of Corrections. I'll find his name in a moment.
It's okay. Just, you know.
So that's, and I'm not sure whether that came about because of pressure, because of the things that, you know, some state representatives were insisting on. They are insisting on now on being given a tour of the facility. They're insisting on answers to questions about the safety and security of inmates now at Lee and of corrections officers now. Obviously, there are still cell phones inside, contraband cell phones inside. Otherwise, we wouldn't be getting these reports and images and videos of the conditions. So
it's one of the ironies, I think, of this story. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, and I'll be talking to Heather Ann Thompson later, but one of her big premises has always been that we need as much transparency in prisons as possible. And we kind of move toward the idea that we should have, that the public should have no access to prisons. And what we really need is more access to prisons. Does South Carolina have video cameras throughout their facilities? Or do you know that?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that it's hard to get information from them. They did not respond to any, you know, I sent over a detailed list of questions to the SCDC. They promised to respond. They never did. And I know that other reporters have had to file FOIA requests just for, when you go to the SCDC's website, I looked at the information they do track, and they track assaults on correction officers, but they don't track inmate on inmate violence. And you know, my sources have said they've really had to fight for that information. So it's not a very transparent system. And you know, it was really striking to me the way
I found that to be one of the most upsetting things. I mean, there have been several things that really upset me, but his response was, I thought, particularly inappropriate, if anyone who hasn't heard it, basically said prisoners are violent and prison won't change them from being violent. So essentially he was saying it was inevitable, right?
Right. But that really doesn't track when you look at the problem South Carolina's had compared to other states. It's not an answer. And I think the problem here is that it became visible. You know, it's becoming visible. The problem for them is when these issues become visible. And the same thing happened with the solitary and the mental health abuses case. You know, the judge came down and said, look, SCDC knew for 10 years that it had this dire problem and did nothing. It willfully allowed these problems and this abuse to persist. So without that light of day, without that sunlight, I don't believe.
So I guess the good news is all of us are trying to bring some sunlight to the situation.
Right. And we've got now a third party review pending. I don't know much about the lead investigator. He's formerly from he retired, I think, in 2016 from the Texas Department of Corrections, but brings a very different level of expertise. He actually came out to the Guggenheim Justice Conference in New York at John Jay with the Crime Report, and I did hear him speak. So he was one of a few panelists talking about, you know, supporting prisoners during reentry.
So to kind of close, what's you know, in all the people you've talked with and all the things you've seen, What really stands out to you the most? What would you sort of sum up your experience with?
You mean what would, are you talking about something that strikes me as hopeful or as a direction that might
whatever,
be hopeful or
you know,
something
stands
else?
Out to you or make you think of the most? If it's hopeful, that's fine too.
Yeah. Well, here it is. This is, from my perspective, a number of things stand out. So, you know, I become pretty deeply immersed in a topic very quickly. It doesn't make me an expert on it. But I do become immersed in it for a short period of time. And, you know, for a week I was watching these videos and very graphic images that, of course, we were not able to publish because they're very extremely disturbing. These could have been from Central America. Paul Wright and I were discussing this because he sees images from prisons in Brazil and El Salvador. And I worked for a time in Medellin, Colombia, covering the armed conflict. And to mentally take a step back, you know, take one foot out of the United States and to be looking at this objectively, just, or let's say from the other side of American policy, that was pretty astounding to me to see these images, which of course Prison Legal News did publish. They're there up on the website. So what I came away with is the level of violence that and the level of trauma that everybody is exposed to in that environment, not just the prisoners, not just the inmates, but the correction officers, the guards, even the people who are inflicting trauma, punishment, pain. And we saw that also in Guantanamo and studies of physicians and what they endured being part of it.
It's incredible. I mean, just even in the short time that I was in, how much just unbelievably traumatic things that, you know, I experienced, and I got away much lighter than, you know, a lot of people.
Well, I've just, you know, when there's a focus on punishment and there's this focus on, I think there's an objection, especially in a political environment like South Carolina, where you have a gubernatorial candidate calling for, you know, her first response after the riots was to say, this is why we need to bring back the firing squad. You know, very punishment oriented context here, where it's not just about public safety, it's about punishment. I wonder to the extent to which we are harming ourselves as a society by inflicting punishment. And, you know, even if you've got take a conservative point of view, which, you know, conservatives against the death penalty will say, look, you know, they're perhaps not as enticed to being against the death penalty because of feeling pity or sorrow or for a particular offender. But I mean, I think something to really look at and to ask about is how...
Yeah, I think I've said many times that, you know, as a society, we should always be very reluctant and very upset whenever we have to punish someone, not celebrate it. And unfortunately, we've come to a place in our society where, you know, it's not a punishment's not a bug, it's a feature, and it's something we all enjoy as a society, unfortunately. And I think the results of that are being seen. Mm-hmm. A lot wider than just in the institutions of incarceration. Well, thanks so much for doing this, and really nice to get to talk to you and to hear about the reporting you're doing. All right.
Thank you.
Okay, that is the end of our special episode about the riot at the Lee Correctional Facility. Thanks to Steve and to Victoria for participating. Decarceration Nation is available from iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are aggregated. We are now also available on Spotify. Thanks so much for listening. Catch you next time.